Our featured BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders for this episode are Brothers Brother Foundation, Central Asia Institute, Compassion and Choices. To find out more about these and other BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charities, go to give.org.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor. There are lots of organizations these days that are offering information to people who want to know more about nonprofits and how they operate. And some of them are pretty high quality in terms of the information that they provide. Some of them are very broad in the information that they offer in terms of the number of organizations that they help us better understand. And some are pretty deep. And we're going to talk with one that is, I feel, kind of deep in the amount of information and the depth of information that it offers people who are trying to better understand nonprofit organizations and how they operate. And that is the Center for High Impact Philanthropy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. And with me is the founding executive director of the center, Kat Ruschetta. And Kat has a deep background in this. We're going to get into her background some during the conversation, but she's worked at McKinsey. She worked at Wells Fargo in their corporate community development group. She even was chair, was or maybe still is. Are you still the chair of the board of the Candid organization, which is also a major?
No, I since stepped down from the board and is chair of Candid.
She was Candid, though, during the merger of GuideStar with the Foundation Center, which was obviously a remarkable feat in the infrastructure of our sector. So she's pretty amazing, and we have her here on the show to talk about all the great work she's doing and how her life has led her to this. So Kat, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Art, thank you so much, and thank you for a very generous introduction.
Well, it's deserved. It's deserved. We have a lot of really bright and talented people in our sector, many of whom kind of operate under the radar. And for me, it was a shock when I discovered that you've been around all this time, as I have been in the nonprofit sector, and we'd never met. It just kind of goes to show you that the sector in many ways is very large, and there are people who are doing great work, even in a collateral field like you are with me, that we don't often even connect with. And it's kind of surprising, but it also is a good thing that people have these resources out there that they can use to get the information and insights they need about organizations. But let me just start by asking you, Kat, a little bit about your early history. I see you have a Bachelor of Arts from Yale and an MBA from Wharton, but you weren't always that. How did you get to an interest in attending these institutions, and how did that transition you to work in nonprofit?
So let me start with how I wound up at a place like Yale. And literally last night I was telling my husband, did I really get to do that? Right. I'm the daughter of immigrants who came to the United States from the Philippines. And like many immigrants who leave their families and their home country, they did it in the hopes of a better life for their family. And so it's a very typical, I feel, immigrant story. My mom worked two jobs. It was all about education. In many ways, it's not surprising that I ultimately wound up at a center on philanthropy, because my whole educational life from K through graduating from college, I have been the beneficiary of philanthropy in the form of scholarships. I was extraordinarily fortunate to have gone to a place like Yale. And when I graduated, I was not that familiar with the nonprofit and philanthropic sector, but partly because of my education at Yale and the recognition that I had quite a privileged education, it was instilled in me, as it was in my Catholic grade school and the independent school I went to in high school, that with that privilege comes responsibility. So it wasn't that I was necessarily focused on the nonprofit sector, but I did know that with the training and the networks and the access that I had, there was a responsibility to make a difference in the world. Fast forward, and I wound up teaching English as a second language in Madrid. I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area right around the time people were recognizing the demographic shift in the United States and the growth of Hispanic, Latinx populations around the country and the rise of Spanish as a language spoken across the U.S. And so after I'd been teaching in Madrid, I actually came back to, I came to California thinking I was going to get a role in Hispanic marketing. And instead, while I was doing a lot of informational interviews during the day, I was temping at Wells Fargo's online banking. These were the days of AOL, and you'd hear the modem.
Yeah.
In the evenings, I wrote the handbook for the call center on how to deal with questions for these like new online bankers. And I would talk to people about what I thought I was interested in. I was just a year out of college. And one of my coworkers said, there's an opening in this new group at Wells Fargo called the Corporate Community Development Group. It was combining all the community-facing activities of the bank. And they said, technically, you're not eligible because you're not yet an employee of the bank, but you should go for it and we'll sponsor you. And so that was my first professional role working with nonprofit organizations.
And then, you know, you start doing work at McKinsey. So talk to me about that, because McKinsey is such a big footprint in the nonprofit sector too, you know.
It does. And I would say there a lot happened between that role at Wells Fargo when I ultimately went to McKinsey. So I wound up spending 10 years. I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, but I spent 10 years in the San Francisco Bay Area, first working at Wells Fargo's Corporate Community Development Group, then starting something called Board Match Plus, which is a nonprofit that recruits and supports nonprofit boards of directors. And then I was with New Schools Venture Fund, which is one of the first venture philanthropy funds in the country. At that point, after those 10 years, frankly, I got tired of people telling me nonprofits have to be more businesslike. And I was like, what do you mean by that? I mean, I know what it was. It was basically code for nonprofits have to be more quote unquote effective. But you and I both know there are plenty of ineffective businesses. So like, and I wound up going to Wharton back at my hometown for business school, because I wanted to find out exactly what do people mean by that? What does it mean to be more businesslike? And I knew at that time that there was a language and a kind of analyses that if I gained them through business school, it would just add more tools to my toolkit in terms of being a leader more broadly. So it was at Wharton after my first year that I was recruited as a summer associate to McKinsey. And McKinsey, like a lot of these big consulting firms, they source talent from these business schools. So in a way, it was a pretty easy transition because I was already at Wharton. I have to say, I was not looking when I came to Wharton to go to a place like McKinsey. I was 10 years out of undergrad. I had led programs. I had a very bad attitude about consulting firms in general, right? Like, pay a lot of money, ask them what to do with your broken watch. They say it's broken. I was like, yeah, right. That's what I paid you for. Like, that was my attitude about consulting firms. Some of my classmates and my husband who said, you know, you came to business school in part as a compliment to all the experience you already had in the nonprofit and social sector. Even if you stay for a couple of years, I think you'll learn a lot from and with these people. And that's yeah. exactly what happened, is that I am still, when I look back at it, shocked at how long I spent there, 5 years and 2 maternity leaves. But I learned a tremendous amount in terms of, it honed my analytical skills. It taught me how to go into really ambiguous situations and ways to get smart quickly so you can be helpful. It was from Wharton that I wound up going to McKinsey.
You know, it's interesting. First of all, I forgot you were from Philly.
That's right. We share that. Yes.
We share Philadelphia as a background. You know, just from the early conversation that we had a few weeks ago, you don't strike me as being a Philly person.
Okay, now you've got to tell me like what's behind
yeah,
that.
Because what I'm going to say is that, I don't know, my city is gritty.
Sure is.
It's like really gritty.
Sure is.
And, you know, here you are, you know, you're this Yale, not that we don't have smart people. We have really smart people in Philly. But you're also very worldly, it seems to me. And you understand like the broader perspective. And I don't mean to put my city down, because I know I'm going to get a lot of flack from this. But sometimes we can be very parochial in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And Philly is the entire world, you know.
Yep.
When I left our city to move to Washington, Kat, I finally realized that life didn't have to be that hard. You know, we have a real sense of scarcity sometimes.
Oh, Philadelphians have like one of the biggest chips on their shoulders like you will ever find, right?
Yeah, you know.
I mean, and our sort of underdog sports teams totally reflect the character of our city.
Right.
So, like I said, born and raised in Philadelphia, parents came to Philly at a time where, like, there is, and still, there's not a big Filipino community in Philadelphia, right? So, yeah. And I love this city. I think it's like what you said, that there is a grit. There's deep poverty, right?
Yeah.
There's a tenacity. And I think partly because of the geography of it, there are neighborhoods. Like the joke is, if you meet somebody from Philly, what do you ask them? What high school did you go to? Right.
Yeah,
And that to me, it is a healthy and old fashioned sense of community. There is a book by a Harvard professor called Bowling Alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
That talked about the sort of decline of our civic and social fabric. The idea is that like there used to be bowling leagues and now like some of those loose ties have been torn. And he describes a neighborhood. And I remember reading it, you know, we had just bought our first house in Philly, a red brick row house, right? Very Philly home. And I remember thinking, he's writing about it as though this no longer exists. But that's my neighborhood, right? Like that's, I have neighbors across the street when my kids were little and on the stoop. And if they saw something that they didn't like, they had no qualms telling my kids to cut that and then to tell me later. So for me, it's, I both have had the privilege of being associated with these sort of globally recognized institutions, like a place like Yale and Penn and Wharton. And I find Philadelphia just really grounding, right? People live their lives and it can be tough. And they also know how to take care of each other.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel that too. And there's no anonymity in Philadelphia.
Well,
right. I, when I moved to Washington, I know we're taking a lot of time on this, but it's fine. When I moved to Washington, you know, you could go months without talking to a neighbor.
Oh, yeah.
In Philly, now, you're going to be known. People are going to know you. They're going to know when you come, when you go. Mm-hmm. You know, it's different. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, but that's Philly. And I guess part of the reason I'm asking you is growing up in Philly, you probably saw a lot too. You saw a lot of need. You saw a lot of passionate people probably working to address some of those things. Some of my first experiences with nonprofits were through Philadelphia institutions like the Christian Street YMCA, where I learned how to play basketball, or the church that I attended, or the Reed House, which was a camp down in South Philadelphia that I attended as a kid. A lot of the recreation centers that the Philadelphia city used to manage. So there were lots of institutions that were very formative in my life in Philadelphia that both projected the grit that we're talking about, but also had people, men and women, who were trying to teach certain values and trying to help us, those of us who were raised in poor communities, find ways to rise above it. Not every one of us did, but those of us who did are recognized and appreciated for what we were able to accomplish. And I would say are still looking for ways to give back. I'm still actively involved in several institutions in Philadelphia and will always try to find something that I can do to be supportive. But that's Philadelphia. You know, that's Philadelphia. What was it for you maybe that you saw growing up that may have maybe inculcated some values? Was it school? Was it other institutions, family? What was it for you?
One of the ways in which Filipinos are described is that they've spent 500 years in the convent, 50 years in Hollywood. Mm. That's referring to the 500 years that it was essentially a property colony of Spain, and then later on of the United States. And so one of the deeply influential forces in my life had been the Catholic school that I went to. Philadelphia and Boston are both known for having, because they're older cities, and because they've always had relatively large Catholic populations, the school system is really public, independent, and Catholic. At the time that I was going to Catholic school, I was kind of taught by these hippie nuns.
Where did you go?
So I went to an independent Catholic school called Norwood Fontbonne Academy, right? On scholarship.
Okay.
I mentioned it about, but for sure in my Catholic school, lots of lessons about it is your responsibility to take care of your brothers and sisters. One of the things that I've shared with some people is that my family was in a car accident when I was 15. And I lost half my family in that car accident.
Oh my God.
My dad, my grandmother, my younger brother. And it's when you go through a crisis like that, that you understand you only survive because of the support that the community gives you.
Absolutely.
Right? And I was still only 15 years old, and I had already graduated from that Catholic school. But they took care of me and my family. Like, meals started showing up.
Wow.
One of the offers of how can we help with finances, who needs rides, that kind of just community coming together. I mean, it's very much, I always say when people who come from outside of the United States and attend our High Impact Philanthropy Academy, and they ask, like, oh, we want to have a nonprofit philanthropic sector like you have in the United States. And I always remind them, this is in many ways uniquely of the United States. When you have a country, when it was founded in revolt of a sovereign, did not have a landed aristocracy, people had to take care of each other. And it's what de Tocqueville said, right? This notion of a voluntary organization, people watching out for each other, like that is pretty deep in the DNA of this country and its history. And one of the other reasons why I love having come back to Philadelphia and to teach and work in philanthropy is you walk around this city where you have the first library, the first hospital, right? You see the signs for mutual benefit associations, right? You see the very beginnings of philanthropy and a philanthropic sector here in this city.
Well, first of all, let me, obviously I didn't know about your family. Let me just, I know it's been a while, but at least offer you condolences on that. I know it's something that you obviously continue to live through. It's not something that ever goes away. But it's so interesting that you mentioned this. And yeah, I wasn't thinking it was going to come up. I had no idea. But there's always something in our background, whether it's a great opportunity or a trauma, that also helps us gain grounding in what it means to have community and how organizations, as well as activism, but I'm kind of an organizational person, matter so much. And what you're doing is helping us now understand those organizations, how they can be effective, how they are sometimes not so effective, what their leaders are like, what leaders need to be, and providing us with information that we can use to better assess them. Talk about some of that work that you're doing at the Center for High Impact Philanthropy now to help us with that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you sort of started with the nonprofit organization.
Yeah.
Because for us and our team, unlike some of the great work that your organization is doing and Candid, our unit of analysis has never been the nonprofit.
Interesting. Okay.
And in a way, we hope that that is a very helpful and unique perspective to bring to our sector. Mm-hmm. Because if you think of the issues or the causes that nonprofit organizations are trying to address today, whether it's food insecurity, housing insecurity, the need for a more sustainable planet, civil rights, gender equity, disaster response, right? In many ways, these causes, these issues, societal problems have always existed. Poverty has always existed. Inequity has always existed. And nonprofits often are at the forefront of trying to address them. It's sort of like nonprofit. I always say nonprofits truly are R&D for society. Mm-hmm. Because they are working on those issues that have been, they're resistant to all the money that the private sector has, right? Because there's no way to make money. You know, people haven't figured out a way to make money off in these, some of these cause areas. And they remain, even with one of the wealthiest governments, if not the wealth in the world, right? So this is the stuff that like, it's still there. It's still, and nonprofits go after that. What we do though, is because we know these issue areas, these problems have existed for a while, and we're based at a university, we also know that there is a lot of knowledge about the nature of these problems and what we know works and doesn't work. And so our unit of analysis tends to be at the level of the cause area.
Good.
What do we know about this problem? What do we know? What have been some of the more successful attempts? What have been some of the failures? And what we aim to do is package that, make sense of it. So, you know, at our best, I feel like our primary role is sense making, right? We will do the legwork, we meaning our multidisciplinary team, so that some of that knowledge actually becomes useful, right? It's not locked up in a peer-reviewed journal. And we don't just look at academic research. We seek that knowledge from practitioners, from the nonprofits themselves. We'll look at good policy analysis. And our hope is that by doing the legwork of sourcing and making sense of the evidence broadly defined and making that information publicly available from our website, we are helping philanthropists recognize the organizations, the nonprofits that are best positioned to make a difference.
Yeah, very well said. Now, let me ask you about some examples. Give me an example of a cause area, for instance, that you've been tracking and that you've found some interesting information for us to know.
One of the things that a lot of people around the world and in the US are concerned about is polarization. We live in a democracy, and we're not able to address some of these societal needs because we are so polarized and our government is dysfunctional. And one of the things that we know helps a democracy and the citizens within a democracy hold government accountable and make sure they're working on the priorities that matter to all of us is the existence of trusted, high quality information. But we're in the midst of a breakdown of the traditional model of journalism. And so one of the things that we've looked at is, what are some of the bright spots that can make sure every person has access to the information that they need to live their lives wherever they live, to hold people of power and institutions of power accountable, to understand who else cares about the issues they care about and prioritize what gets done. And so I'm just coming back from the Knight Media Forum, which for 13 years has been convening folks around this. And there are some really interesting, again, if you think of nonprofits as R&D for society, nonprofit experiments around rethinking and rebuilding the infrastructure of how people across this country get news and information. Press Forward is one, the American Journalism Project or another. I mean, and that is really reimagining. We know the system is broken now. We know there are thousands of communities that have zero access to local news and information. We know that the national outlets, because they are commercial, they are more driven to clickbait and polarization, right? Because when you rile us up, right, that gets our attention. And so that's something that I feel like it's a bummer we have to rebuild it, but that rebuilding it, the nonprofit sector and the philanthropists and the funders who are helping, that's a pillar for a strong and thriving democracy. Something that we all want.
And now it's time for our giving tips segment with Bennett Weiner, one of the world's most renowned experts on charity accountability and the COO of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
Today I'd like to talk about the importance of the clarity of program descriptions that appear on charity websites and in their solicitations to the public. Our recommendation is that charities should ensure that those types of communications include a clear description of what the charity does. You shouldn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out what the organization is all about. Are they upfront with what their main activities are? And they should be. Sometimes charities may assume too much. And what I mean by that is, let's say if they are soliciting individuals who have given before to the organization and are asking for them to renew their support. The charity may assume the individual knows or remembers what they do and doesn't really describe their activities. That's a mistake. Individuals are supporting generally a variety of organizations. They're not going to remember what each one does necessarily. And it's important for organizations to be upfront as to how the collected monies are going to be used. So it's important for organizations to make sure there is a clear description, even if it's brief, about what the organization is all about when they're asking people to support them.
On another note, let me ask you about some of the giving data that we've seen. And I just want to get your impression of this decline that we've seen in the number of people giving to organizations. And I just wonder, in your opinion, is that somehow linked to the decline in trust in institutions and government and so forth? And do you see any path forward for us to regain the interest of everyday people in contributing to organizations again? Or let me just restate that a little bit. Not just organizations, but contributing to creating change that they want to see in their communities, because that goes back to what you were saying earlier about we just had to build it because we were running away from a sovereign and we had to take care of each other. Well, are people taking care of each other if they're not doing it through institutions? Uh-huh. Maybe they are, uh-huh. maybe they aren't. I don't uh-huh. know. What's your thought?
Yeah, on? Yeah. There are a lot of factors that I think have contributed to what we see is a decline in individual households giving to nonprofit organizations.
Yeah.
Right? That's the data that you're referring to. Now, some of that, I suspect, has to do with the increasing wealth disparity.
Yeah.
Because unlike about, say, 20, 25 years ago, when close to 80% of households gave to nonprofit organizations as measured by tax data. Mm-hmm. Now it's much lower, closer to 60. And it's the amount of money is disproportionately allocated by very wealthy individuals. Mm-hmm. And so philanthropy, if you're just defining philanthropy as money that is being used to support tax-exempt nonprofit organizations, then it's no surprise when there's growing wealth disparity, there's sort of less money, quote-unquote, left over to be given to nonprofit organizations. At the same time, that is a relatively narrow definition of philanthropy, right? Philanthropy is from the Greek love of humanity. So if you think of philanthropy more broadly as it is the use of private resources, my time, my money, but in service of the public good in terms of helping another human being, then I worry about the decline of financial support for some of these nonprofit institutions that are doing good work in every community. And I also want to understand, given things like new technological platforms and the still uncounted support that we give, like the story I told earlier about the meals just arriving at my family, like,
right.
Are we doing our communities and our society a disservice by not counting that as philanthropy? I think it's very hard to understand philanthropy without figuring out, like, well, what about all that good work? Are we not going to call the person who, like, provided meals to their neighbor for weeks as a philanthropist? Why not? Because if, like my earlier story, if you go back to the origins of philanthropy, particularly in this country, it was about us individuals seeing a need and figuring out how are we going to address that. And so I am concerned because nonprofit institutions have always played a critical role in both advancing society and serving as a safety net where government doesn't. So it is troubling that we're seeing a decline in support there. And I think we also need to understand the types of philanthropic acts that so far are not being counted, but that really matter to people.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know what I'm really concerned about, though? I worry that everyday people will say, yes, we do need to take care of each other, but it's not my responsibility. It's the wealthy person's responsibility to do that. And I think we lose something mm-hmm. in that way of thinking. And it is the agency and the freedom that those institutions have because of a more broad-based support, standing in for those individuals who gave relatively small amounts of money, but lots of them.
Yeah.
So I worry about that. And to some extent, I worry that while we certainly we appreciate the support that institutions get from really wealthy people, that's wonderful, right? We certainly want to encourage them to continue doing that. Will there engagement at that level also influence organizations to do things that aren't the kinds of things that they should be doing for community. I do worry about that. I don't know what the answer is, but I do worry about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an absolutely valid worry.
Yeah.
Because wealth is power.
Yeah.
Right. And with that power, those who have power set priorities.
Yeah.
But if you think about the needs in any given community, the wealthiest among us are often insulated from those needs. So they're kind of clueless.
Right.
You do not want the people who are kind of clueless determining, prioritizing what needs to get done. I would say to those people who think, well, it's not my responsibility, it's wealthy people's responsibility, or it's the government's responsibility, I would say, oh no, this only works if it's all of our responsibility. That's the only way this works.
Nobody's going to take care of you but you
yep.
in some ways. So, well, look, Kat, I wanted to just hit on one other thing before we have to wrap up this episode. And it is, tell me about your work at Penn more broadly. So, and how the center kind of fits into everything that's happening there.
Our center, the Center for High Impact Philanthropy, was founded originally as a collaboration between alumni of the Wharton School, which is the oldest collegiate business school in the world, and folks from the School of Social Policy and Practice, which is where we're housed, which is one of the oldest schools of social work in the country, one of only two in the Ivy League. So one way to think of the center, it is MBA meets social worker. And if those are the parents of the center, I always mention that because our team and our approach has been deeply multidisciplinary from the very beginning. There is no, this is not about nonprofits needing to be more business-like. This is about if you are looking at, say, addressing low literacy rates in a city, some of what we know to help there might be at the Graduate School of Education. Some might be from organizationally, how do we address an issue like that? That might come from a place like Wharton. The School of Social Policy and Practice is the home of a master's in social work, a master's in social policy, and the nonprofit leadership program. All of those perspectives help us understand for any different cause area, what's the nature of the problem, what has worked, what hasn't worked. And so our mission is to be an independent source of knowledge and education on how philanthropy can do more good. And our home at the university and the multidisciplinary team and the perspectives that we can tap from, Penn has 12 schools, and from the amazing students who serve as, they have practicum placements at our center, they serve as research assistants. When I said earlier that we feel like we are at our best when we are making sense of a lot of information and turning it into something useful and practical for decision makers. And we wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't have the platform of a university like Penn with all those disciplines, with faculty, with practitioners, training grounds, and for students. And we use all of that to power our mission.
Well, listen, everyone, you have just heard Kat Ruschetta. She's the executive director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy at the University of Pennsylvania. You obviously are now aware of this if you haven't been before. And we are just so grateful to you, Kat, for being so open with us. And we learned so much, not only about the center, but about you. And the stories about the guests are really important for what we're trying to do with this podcast. Because listening to your story, I know that there will be others who see themselves through you and are now going to be able to say, okay, there's some elements of her life that I see my life being shaped around. And you said some things about the importance of giving and how our society was formed that maybe will nudge some people to rethink how they engage in community. So thank you for that. And I also want to say, I'm just so looking forward to continuing our relationship. I think we've got some really interesting things to do together down the road. And I'm looking forward to that. One of the things I wanted to mention to you, you mentioned polarization. Well, I happen to chair the board of an organization called Convergence Policy. And it is an organization that is focused on dealing with polarization by sitting people at a table for a long period, maybe 18 months, and seeing if they can find common ground and then coming up with a policy solution to a difficult problem. And I want to invite you to learn more about that organization. I have some ideas about that. And of course, there's so much more we can do both at the institution, at Penn, and through the center with the Wise Giving Alliance. So I'm looking forward to working with you. And it's so great to find another really passionate individual about nonprofit work living in my hometown.
Yeah.
And so I really look forward to our relationship growing from here.
Well, same here, Art. You said earlier, how could we not know each other? Right. And now that we do, I think there's all sorts of good trouble to be done.
Well, listen, to all of our listeners, if this is the first time you've heard this show, it's a weekly podcast. And every Tuesday, there's a new episode. So I hope you will listen regularly, become a subscriber. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do that too by making a gift at give.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.